This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 3, given in Dornach on March 23, 1920. In the course of the lectures to come, I will make use of all of the requests that have been presented to me. Some of these requests may duplicate one another, so I need to have collected at least most of them before I begin. It will also make a difference whether we discuss them before or after a certain foundation has been laid. Today, therefore, I will attempt to create such a foundation for everything that will follow, taking into account what I have noted from your requests thus far. As you have seen, I attempted to take the morphology and inner function of the bony and muscular systems as the starting point for what we considered in the first lecture. Then, yesterday, we progressed at least far enough to give examples of the disease process and the requirements of therapy, taking the circulation of blood in the cardiac system as our example and point of departure. Now, today, I would like to present a few additional introductory thoughts about a way of looking at the overall possibility and general character of healing, a view that can be acquired through a more profound consideration of humankind. We will go into the details in later lectures, but I would like to discuss these fundamentals first. If you think about the character of modern medical education, you will find, for the most part, that therapy is taught parallel to pathology, without any clearly understandable connection between the two. Especially with regard to therapy, a merely empirical methodology is often the only approach, and totally dominates the scene. And we find almost no rational principles that could form the basis for practical therapeutic work. We know that in the course of the 19th century, these deficits in medical thinking even led to the nihilistic school of medical thought, which emphasized diagnosis almost exclusively. Its practitioners were actually content to identify illnesses and generally took a very skeptical view of any rational basis for healing. If we were to make purely rational demands on the medical profession, we would actually have to say that an indication of a cure ought to be inherent in the diagnosis. A mere outer connection between therapy and pathology cannot be allowed to prevail. Our understanding of the nature of an illness must be able to lead to insight into the process of curing it. A related question, of course, is to what extent are therapeutic substances and processes present in the overall context of natural processes? Paracelsus is often quoted as saying something very interesting, that physicians must pass the test of nature. It cannot be said, however, that the modern literature on Paracelsus knows what to do with an aphorism like this. If it did, it would be intent on discovering healing processes by listening to nature. Admittedly, this search is indeed attempted in the case of disease processes that nature can cope with. But as a result, nature is observed only in exceptional cases, when damage has already set in, and nature knows what to do about it, whereas a true study of nature involves observing its normal processes. This study ought to give rise to the question of whether it is actually possible to observe so-called normal processes in nature in a way that yields insight into healing processes. You will notice immediately that this question is connected to another somewhat dubious question, since healing processes in nature can obviously be studied in a normal way only when disease processes are normal occurrences in nature. So the question arises, are disease processes present in nature as such, so that we can learn to heal by passing nature's test? Although the answer to this question will emerge completely only as we continue with these lectures, we will attempt at least to get a bit closer to it today. But we can say immediately that the conventional scientific basis of medicine obstructs the path we are setting out on here. Current assumptions make it extremely difficult to go this route because, strange as it may seem, 19th century materialistic tendencies have led to a complete misunderstanding of the functions of the nervous system, which is the next system I will discuss, in addition to the skeletal, muscular, and cardiac systems. It has gradually become customary to saddle the nervous system with everything that is soul-like in character. All the processes of spirit or soul taking place in the human being are thought to be subsumed by parallel processes found in the nervous system. Now you know that in my book titled Riddles of the Soul, I found it necessary to object to this way of studying nature. In that book, I made an initial attempt to demonstrate that only perceptive processes as such are connected to the nervous system, while all emotional processes connect directly rather than indirectly to the organism's rhythmical processes. Our studies here will yield a great deal of empirical confirmation of these truths. Today's scientists normally think that emotional processes have nothing to do with the rhythmic system directly, except inasmuch as these rhythmical processes are transmitted to the nervous system. They think that emotional activity is played out in the nervous system. Similarly, I attempted to show that all of our volitional activity is connected to the metabolic system directly, rather than indirectly via the nervous system. With regard to volitional processes, all that is left for the nervous system to do is to perceive them. The nervous system does not stage acts of will. It simply perceives what takes place in us as a result of volition. Everything I stated in Riddles of the Soul can definitely be confirmed by the relevant biological facts, whereas the opposing view that attributes psychological activity to the nervous system alone cannot be confirmed at all. It is possible for a so-called motor nerve to be severed and then allowed to grow back together into a single nerve. For once, I would like to see how healthy reason can connect this fact with the other assumption that there are nerves that serve both sensory and motor functions. Such nerves do not exist. What we call motor nerves are nothing other than sensory nerves that perceive the movements of our limbs. That is, they perceive what is going on in the metabolism of our limbs during an act of will. Thus, in reality, motor nerves are sensory nerves that perceive only what is going on inside us, while what we ordinarily call sensory nerves perceive the outer world. Moving in this direction, we encounter something that is enormously important for medicine, but can be given its due only when we take a good look at the actual facts of the matter. Especially if we are faced with the symptoms I took as our starting point yesterday in developing the example of tuberculosis, it is difficult to make do with the assumption that separate sensory and motor nerves exist. Sensible researchers have therefore assumed that each nerve conducts impulses in both directions, rather than only from the periphery toward the center, or vice versa. Similarly, then, each motor nerve would have to lead in two directions, which means that if we take the nervous system as our basis for explaining any phenomenon, such as hysteria, we find it necessary to assume that two lines of conduction exist, running in opposite directions. Thus, as soon as we get down to facts, we are already forced to assume that nerves have properties that totally contradict current hypotheses about the nervous system. Through having learned to think about the nervous system in the prevalent way, we have actually obstructed everything we ought to know about other things that take place in the organism below the level of the nervous system. What happens in hysteria, for example. Yesterday we characterized what happens in hysteria as metabolic processes that are simply perceived by means of the nerves. More careful attention should have been paid to this in the past, but instead the origins of hysteria were sought only in some kind of instability of or shock to the nervous system, and the entire responsibility was mistakenly laid on the nervous system. Something else, then, happened as a result. It cannot be denied that some of the more distant causes of hysteria are psychological ones, grief, disappointments, inner urges that may or may not be able to be fulfilled, that then turn into symptoms of hysteria. By separating the rest of the organism from the nervous system, and directly associating the soul's activity exclusively with the nervous system, we are forced to hold a nervous system responsible for everything. This has led to a view that no longer corresponds in the least to the facts, and also leaves us with no means of linking the soul to the human organism as a whole. We can link it only to the nervous system. The soul aspect cannot be linked to the human organism as a whole, except possibly by inventing motor nerves that do not exist, and then expecting motor nerve functions to influence circulation and so forth, all of which is hypothetical in the extreme. What I have presented here has led even the most intelligent people astray in cases of autosuggestion and hypnosis and the like. These cases, which occurred some time ago, involved hysterical ladies misguiding the cleverest physicians and leading them around by the nose. This could happen simply because it was impossible to investigate what was going on within the body. Consequently, people fell for all kinds of behavior that such patients put on for the benefit of their doctors. In this context, it may be interesting to point out Dr. Schleich's error, although this case involves a hysterical man rather than an hysterical woman. Footnote: Carl Ludwig Schleich, 1859-1922, the discoverer of local anesthesia. This incident is described in his memoir Besonnte Vergangenheit, The Happy Past. Other works are Von Schaltwerk der Gedanken, The Switching Mechanism of Thoughts, Bewusstsein und Unsterblichkeit, Consciousness and Immortality, and Von der Seele, Essays on the Soul. End of footnote. In spite of being accustomed to thinking quite clearly about such matters, Schleich committed an unavoidable error. He was consulted by a man who had pricked his finger with an inky pinpoint and said that this would surely lead to his death that same night. Blood poisoning would set in, so his arm needed to be amputated. It is obvious that Schleich, a surgeon, could not amputate under such circumstances. He could merely reassure the man and do what was necessary, clean out the wound, and so forth. But of course he could not amputate simply because the man claimed he would develop blood poisoning that same night. The patient in question then went to some other expert, who also did not amputate his arm, of course. But Schleich felt somewhat uneasy about the situation. The next morning he inquired immediately, and in fact his patient really had died during the night. Schleich put forward a diagnosis of death by autosuggestion. Diagnosing death by autosuggestion is obvious in this case, terribly obvious. But if we have any insight into the human being, it is simply not acceptable to think of this death, to think of this as death, by autosuggestion in that sense. If we do, we are fundamentally confusing cause and effect. Results of the autopsy showed that blood poisoning had not set in, so the man in question had died, so it seemed, of a cause that remained unknown to the doctors. Someone capable of understanding this situation clearly, however, would conclude that the patient must certainly have died of a cause that was deeply rooted in his organism. On the previous day, this cause had made the man somewhat shaky and unsteady, so that he pricked his finger with the inky pen. This was a consequence of his shakiness, something that would not have happened otherwise. But while, outwardly, he became physically unsteady, his inner perceptive abilities were somewhat heightened. Under the influence of his illness, he had a prophetic premonition of his death the following night. This death had nothing at all to do with the fact that he had pricked his finger on an inky pen. Instead, his imminent death was the cause of what he was feeling, and the entire incident was only superficially connected to the actual inner processes leading to death. There is no question in this case of, quote, death by autosuggestion, close quote. The man's belief that he was going to die had deeper roots, and had nothing to do with actually bringing about his death. However, he did foresee his death, and interpreted everything that happened in the light of this premonition. This example will show you immediately how incredibly careful we must be if we want to arrive at an objective assessment of the complicated processes going on in nature. We cannot afford to take the very simplest assumption as our starting point. But now, we will have to ask the question, do sense perceptions and similar processes offer us a clue to the effects of a somewhat different sort that medications are meant to have on the human organism? You will agree that there are three kinds of influencing the human organism in its normal function: via sensory perceptions that are taken further by the nervous system, via the rhythmic system of respiration and circulation, and via the metabolism. These three normal relationships must have analogies of some sort in the abnormal relationship we bring about between therapeutic substances, which must also be derived from outer nature in some way, and the human organism. Admittedly, what takes place between the outer world and the human organism is most clearly apparent in the nervous system. We must, therefore, ask ourselves how we can rationally conceive of the connection between the human being and the non-human external nature that we want to utilize, either in the form of processes or in the form of therapeutic substances, in order to bring about healing in the human being. We must achieve a clear view of the interrelationship between the human being and external nature, the source of our medicines. Even if we apply only cold water treatments, we are using something external to the human being. Everything we use is taken from outside the human being and then applied to human processes. And we must achieve a rational view of the nature of the connection between the human being and outer non-human processes. Admittedly, we are now coming to another chapter of conventional medical education that is governed by pure aggregation rather than by any organic connection among its parts. Although medical students listen to preparatory scientific lectures, their later courses on general and specialized pathology and general therapeutic methods are then based on this preparatory science, and so on and so forth. By the time the actual medical courses begin, not much more is heard about how the processes, and especially the therapeutic methods, covered in their medical lectures relate to processes in outer nature. I believe that physicians have undergone modern medical training, will not only experience this outwardly and rationally as a deficit, but will also carry it with them as a strong feeling that will force itself upon them when practical intervention in a disease process is called for, a feeling of uncertainty as to whether to use one medication or another. In actuality, they very seldom have any real knowledge of how the chosen remedy relates to what is going on in the human being. This is a case in which the very nature of the matter points to a much-needed reform in the education of physicians. Today, I would like to make use of specific processes in outer non-human nature to illustrate how they differ in many respects from the natural processes occurring in the human being. I would like to begin with processes that can be observed in plants and lower animals, and from there we will find our way to those that can be induced by substances we extract from non-human nature in general, whether from the plant or animal kingdoms, or particularly from the mineral kingdom. But we can approach the essential character of pure mineral substances only by taking very elementary scientific ideas as our point of departure, and then proceeding to what happens. For example, if we use arsenic or tin or any other substance as a remedy that is introduced into the human organism. The first thing that needs to be pointed out is that the metamorphoses taking place during growth in non-human organisms are completely different from those within humans. We will not be able to avoid formulating the different principles that apply to living growth both in human and non-human beings. The difference that appears here is of fundamental significance. For example, observe the common black locust, Robinia pseudacacia. If you cut its leaflets off at the petioles, something interesting happens. The petioles metamorphose somewhat, and then these transformed knobby petioles take over the function of the leaves. Petioles is spelled P-E-T-I-O-L-E-S. To begin with, we will hypothesize that what is so highly active here is a force that is present throughout the plant and that comes to expression when we prevent the plant from using one of its normally developed organs for specific functions. A remnant of what is markedly present in a plant, which is simpler in its growth patterns, becomes evident in a human being who is prevented for some reason from using one arm or hand for some purposes. The other hand develops more strongly, becomes physically larger, and so forth. We must make the connection between such things, because that is the route to recognizing a possible method of healing. Now, in outer non-human nature, this phenomenon is taken to great lengths. For example, if we observe plants growing on a cliff, we may find that certain petioles of the plants, develop without ever forming leaves. The leaves are absent. Instead, certain petioles bend over in order to support the plant. The leaves remain undeveloped, and instead the plants have these leafless, transformed petioles that serve as organs of support. And there's a drawing. This is indicative of the plant's inner formative forces, which make it possible for the plant to adapt to a great extent to the mode of life demanded by its environment. Especially in lower organisms, we encounter very interesting forces like this. For example, if you take any embryo that has advanced to the gastrula stage, you can cut it in half down the middle, and each piece will close up and be able to develop the three parts, upper, middle, and lower, of its own intestinal tract. If we cut a gastrula in half, we discover that each half behaves the way the uncut whole would have behaved. You know that this experiment can be carried further with lower animals, even earthworms, and that pieces cut off of certain lower animals will regrow. That is, the animal's internal formative forces replace the parts we have cut off. These formative forces must be pointed out objectively, not merely by hypothesizing about some sort of life force, but really objectively. If we observe more closely, if we really follow what is actually going on, we can see, for example, that if we cut off part of a frog's body at a very early stage of its development, the rest of the organism puts out a new part. If your way of thinking is materialistically inclined, you may say that there are forces of tension present in the wound that will replace what used to grow there. But that cannot be the case. If I cut an organism here, there's another diagram, and a new part developed through forces of tension at the site of the wound, what grew back would have to be what is immediately adjacent to the wound. But in reality, that is not the case. In reality, if you cut off a frog larva's terminal organs, such as the tail, or even the head, or the antenna in other animals, what grows back is not the same as the adjacent part. It is the part that the organism needs. This means that it is totally impossible for forces of tension intrinsic to the wound site to put forth what develops there. On the contrary, we must assume that the whole organism is involved in some way. We can actually trace such things as they occur in lower organisms. Now that I have shown you how to pursue a question like this, you can expand it to all the empirical reports that have accumulated in the literature to date. And in each instance, you will see that this is the only path leading to insight into the matter. Of course, you will say that this is not the case in human beings. It would be nice if we could cut off someone's finger or arm and it would simply grow back. But it doesn't. So the question is, what happened to the formative forces of growth that are so evident in lower animals? What has happened to them in the human organism? Have they been lost? Are they simply not present? Anyone who knows how to observe nature objectively will understand that this is the only path to a natural view of the connection between the spiritual and physical aspects of the human being. In the human being, the forces that we recognize here as sculptural forces, as it were, forces that create forms directly out of substance, have simply been lifted out of the organs and are present only in the human soul and spirit. That is where they are. By being lifted out of the organs, by not remaining organ-forming forces, they are available to human beings for other purposes and are present in the functions of the human soul and spirit. Whenever I think or feel, I think and feel with the same forces that are sculpturally active in the plant kingdom or in the lower animals. I would not be able to think, feel, or will without these same forces that I have extracted from matter. When I look at lower organisms, I must realize that their sculptural forces in place there are the same as those I also carry within myself. I, however, have taken those forces out of my organs and possess them. I think and feel and will with the same forces that are sculpturally active out there in the world of lower organisms. Anyone who wants to become a psychologist, whose constructs have some substance and are not mere words, which is how psychology is construed today, would have to trace the processes of thinking, feeling, and willing in a way that reveals them to be the same forces that appear in lower sculptural formations, but taking place on the level of spirit and soul. Just look at how our inner psychological processes can accomplish a task that we can no longer perform on the organic level. Trains of thought that have escaped us can be finished with others, which we bring in from far away rather than from what is nearest at hand. This function is actually similar to the regrowth of necessary parts of the organism that I mentioned yesterday. What we experience on the inner psychological level completely parallels the natural formative forces and principles that are present in the outer world. There is a true parallelism between them. We need to point this out and to show that, in essence, the formative principle for us human beings in the outer world is our life in soul and in spirit, which we have extracted from the organic level so that it no longer constitutes the formative basis of matter or substance in our own bodies. But we have not extracted it from all parts of the body equally, and we have withdrawn it in different ways. We can approach the human organism in the appropriate way only when we are equipped with the knowledge that we have now developed. If you look at everything constituting our nervous system, you will discover the peculiar fact that neurons, nerve tissue, and so forth, are not usually described as very highly evolved structures. They have remained behind at relatively early stages of evolution. We might expect these so-called nerve cells to demonstrate the character of earlier primitive cell structures. But, in certain other respects, they do not do that at all. For example, they are not capable of reproduction. Neurons, like blood cells, are incapable of self-replication from the moment they are formed. Thus, at a relatively early stage, an ability that is the common property of non-human cells is taken away from them. They remain behind on an earlier developmental level. To some extent, they are paralyzed at this evolutionary stage. The part that is paralyzed takes on a separate existence as the human being's sole spiritual aspect. In reality, our sole spiritual processes hearken back to what formerly assumed organic material form. We achieve this, however, only by incorporating nerve tissue that we kill off, or at least paralyze, at a relatively early stage. In this way, we can approach the essential character of nerve tissue. We then discover the reason for its idiosyncratic character, why it looks so similar to primitive structures on the one hand, even in its further developments, while, on the other hand, it serves what we usually call the highest aspect of the human being, namely spiritual activity. I believe although this is just an aside and is not meant as part of our considerations, that even on superficial examination, the human head, which encloses the different nerve cells within a solid suit of armor, is more reminiscent of lower animals than of highly evolved species. I would go so far as to say that, although it has been transformed, the human head is reminiscent of prehistoric animals. In speaking of lower animals, we usually say that they have external skeletons, while higher animals and humans have internal skeletons, with the exception of our heads. Our most highly developed part has an external skeleton. This is something that could at least be a leitmotif of sorts for what has just been described. Now imagine what can happen to these formative forces, forces that are present in outer non-human nature, but that we ourselves have taken from our organism in order to use them for our spirit and soul. What happens when something we call an illness makes it necessary for us to guide these forces back into the organism by using a remedy, such as a plant or the like? This is a topic I will still speak about later in more detail, but essentially we link the organism to something it is lacking. We help it by supplementing it with something that we withdrew from it by becoming human. Here you can already see the dawning of what can be described as a healing process. We call on the help of forces in nature that we ourselves, as normal human beings, do not possess. We use them when we need to make an inner part of us stronger than it is in a normal human being. If we take one of our organs, the lungs, perhaps, as an example, just so we can talk about this matter in concrete terms, we will find that we have withdrawn formative principles from organs such as this in order to have them available for our soul and spirit. Suppose we discover somewhere in the plant kingdom these same forces that we have withdrawn from our lungs. If we then administer them to a person with a pulmonary disorder, we are coming to the aid of that person's pulmonary functions. You see, the question now arises, which forces in outer non-human nature are similar to the forces that underlie our human organs, but have been withdrawn to serve soul spiritual functions? This route leads away from merely experimental methods toward a rational approach to therapy. In addition to the errors people fell into with regard to the nervous system, which are errors about something inside the human being, a very significant error was committed with regard to nature outside the human being. I will simply point out that this error today, I will simply point out this error today and elaborate on it later. In our materialistic age, people have gradually come to think of the beings of outer nature as having undergone an evolution of sorts, from the so-called simplest to the most complicated. After first extending their view to include lower organisms, they studied morphological transformations right up to the most complex organisms, also taking into account non-organic forms, such as those in the mineral kingdom. In looking at the mineral kingdom, they realized that it is simpler than the plant kingdom. This eventually led to all those strange questions about how life emerged from the mineral kingdom, about the one-time event that made substances come together and abandon their mere inorganic activity for organic activity. The idea of generatio equivoca, spontaneous generation, stimulated many discussions. To an unbiased observer, it is not at all clear that this view is correct. On the contrary, it must be said that in a certain respect it is just as possible to imagine that minerals evolved from living organisms, when life was withdrawn from plants, as it is to imagine an evolution that proceeds from plants, through animals, to humans. As I said, I simply want to point this out today. It will be clarified as we continue our studies. We can come to terms with the issue of evolution only if we do not imagine it as proceeding upward from minerals to plants to animals to humans. Instead, we must choose a starting point in the middle and imagine one upward line of evolution which moves from plants through animals to humans, and another downward evolution that leads to the minerals. That is, instead of taking the mineral kingdom as the starting point, we must begin in the middle, so that some forms result from an ascending line of evolution, others from a descending line. If we do this, we will come to the insight that the forces that appear in the downward evolution from plants to minerals, and especially to metals, which are an exceptionally important mineral type, bear a special relationship to their mirror image in the ascending line of evolution. In short, the question that comes to mind is, what are these special mineral forces that we can study only when we examine, as indeed we did, the formative forces in lower organisms? In the minerals, these forces become visible in crystallization. Crystallization very definitely shows us something that appears when we consider downward evolution. It is somehow related to, but not the same as, the formative forces that become apparent when we consider upward evolution. So, if we introduce the forces in minerals into a living body, a new question arises. We answered a similar question. What happens when we supplement the human organism with formative forces from the plant and animal kingdoms? Forces that our soul and spirit have withdrawn from our own organization. We help the organism. But what happens when the forces we introduce into the human organism are different in quality? What if we use forces that are present in downward evolution, that is, in the mineral kingdom? That is the question I want to pose today. It should be thoroughly answered in the course of our studies here. But we have still not reached the point of being able to make any real contribution to the question we highlighted at the beginning of today's lecture. Can we discover a healing process by listening to nature? In posing such questions, it is always important to approach nature with the appropriate insights. And we have been attempting to acquire at least a sketchy insight into such matters, so that certain processes will reveal their essential character. This is the important point. As you know, there are two distinct processes in the human organism that are also present in animals, although we are less interested in that at the moment. In a certain sense, if we observe these processes equipped with the ideas we have now acquired, it becomes apparent that they are opposite or contrasting functions. I must make a point of emphasizing that this is not entirely true. Please keep this in mind so that you do not misunderstand what I am now going to present. But to a considerable extent, they are polar opposites. These two processes are blood formation and milk formation, as they appear in the human organism. Even outwardly, they differ in very significant ways. Blood formation occurs in the hidden depths of the human organism, while milk formation takes place closer to the surface. If we are considering the human being, the most essential difference between blood formation and milk formation is that blood formation possesses a very strong capacity for developing formative forces. In the overall economy of the human organism, if I may use such a materialistic expression, blood is the element to which formative forces must be attributed. Thus, in some respects, blood still possesses the formative forces that we perceive here in the lower body. They are still present in the blood. Modern science, in particular, would discover a very important support if it would study the blood, but at present it is not taking up this study in a truly rational sense. It would find support in the fact that the red blood cells, which are blood's main component, are not capable of reproduction. They do not have the ability to self-replicate. This is a feature they have in common with neurons. But when we emphasize a shared characteristic, such as this, it is always important to know whether the reason for it is the same in both cases. The reason cannot be the same, because we have not withdrawn formative capacities from the blood to the extent that we have withdrawn them from nerve tissue. Nerve tissue, which forms the basis of our conceptual activity, lacks internal formative capacities to a great extent. In human beings, nerve tissue continues to develop during life after birth. But this development is largely dependent on outer impressions. That is, internal formative capacities give way to the ability to simply adapt to external influences. The situation is different with blood, which retains internal formative capacities to a great extent. In a certain sense, as you know from experience, these internal formative capacities are also present in milk. If they were not, milk would not be a healthy food for infants, and we would not be able to give it to them. What infants need is milk, which contains formative capacities similar to those in blood. Thus, with regard to formative capacities, there is a certain similarity between blood and milk. There is also a considerable difference, however. Milk possesses this formative capacity, but it has very little, only minimal amounts, of one substance blood needs in abundance in order to exist, namely iron, which is the only metal whose compounds in the human organism show a significant ability to crystallize. Thus, although blood does contain small amounts of other metals, the difference is that blood needs iron, a pronounced metallic factor, in order to exist. Milk, which also possesses formative capacities, does not need iron. So the question is, why does blood need it? This question is actually of cardinal importance for medical science as a whole. We know that blood needs iron. We will now gather material evidence to support the facts that I have outlined today. First of all, I will substantiate the statement that blood is the one substance in the human organism that is ill by nature and must constantly be cured by iron. This is not the case with milk. If milk were ill in the same sense as blood, it could not serve, as in fact it does, as a formative agent for human beings, a formative agent that is introduced from outside. When we consider the blood, we are considering the factor in the human being that is constantly diseased for the sake of the human constitution. It is simply the nature of blood to be diseased and to be constantly cured through the addition of iron. That is, the process that takes place in our blood is an ongoing internal healing process. If physicians want to pass the test of nature, it is most important for them to consider one of nature's normal processes rather than one that is abnormal. And the process taking place in blood is certainly a normal one, although it is also one that nature must constantly cure by supplying a mineral, namely iron. In a graphic representation of what happens to the blood, we might depict what blood possesses by virtue of its own constitution, but without the addition of iron, as a downward curve or line that would end in the total dissolution of the blood. And there's a drawing. Meanwhile, what iron accomplishes in the blood, constantly leading it back upward and healing it, could be represented by this yellow line. In actuality, we have here a normal process that must be emulated if we are to think about healing at all. In this instance, we really can pass the test of nature, because we see the processes that nature carries out by introducing a non-human factor, a metal and its forces, into the human being. And at the same time we see how a factor, such as blood, which wants to remain within the organism at all costs, requires healing, while a factor such as milk, which strives to leave the organism, does not, and is able even to transfer formative forces, if, like milk, it contains them, to another organism in a healthy way. Thus, a polarity of sorts exists between blood and milk, not a total polarity, but one that we must look at carefully, because there is a great deal that we can learn from it. We will continue with this topic tomorrow. I had to present all this first, because I realized that your questions will be answered very differently after we acquire the right concepts as a basis for answering them. The end of Lecture 3.